Hello, welcome back to the New History Podcast. We're on episode number 9. My name's Alex, and as always, I'm joined by Lily.
Hello.
And today, our extra special guest is one Gordon McKelvey.
Hi there.
Hi, Gordon. So, if you'd like to introduce yourself, and we can get into whatever you want to talk about.
So I'm Gordon McKelvey. I'm a senior lecturer in medieval history at the University of Winchester. I've been at Winchester for quite a while, longer than I was expecting. I did a PhD at Winchester from 2009 to 2013, under the supervision mainly of Professor Michael Hicks, but also then Doctor, now I think Professor Neil Murphy, really on the statutes of livery in late medieval England. These effectively were laws about really trying to not abolish the private power of nobles and gentry, but trying to rein in the size of their followings and affinities to really just incorporate what was seen as acceptable categories of servants. So from a thesis, I was able to kind of look at all these various laws. But for England, the good thing we have is the records of the King's Bench. So in other words, you can see, well, what are laws being made about? And then you can compare that to, well, are these laws actually being enforced and how are they being enforced? So I got my PhD in 2013. It took me a long time to actually turn that into a book, which I finally did last year.
Whoop.
In the meantime, I also worked various jobs in the academic gig economy, teaching lots of different topics. I also worked in a project based on a set of records called the Inquisition's Postmortem. The project itself was called Mapping the Medieval Countryside, again at Winchester, run by Michael Hicks. But I mainly did an offshoot of that project, which was on the Inquisition's Postmortem, which are records of landholding for the reign of Richard III, because luckily, just as I was looking for a job, they found what is probably Richard III's remains, and therefore they needed there was some interest and some money to edit documents on his life. So I produced an edition on that, and now I'm sort of the kind of the difficult second album stage, trying to find other things to write and talk about, as well. They never tell you that when you're doing your PhD, that there's a lot of analogies with the music industry, where you get your
Oh,
big
yeah.
break, you get your big break, and then you get the first album for the first book, and then what now, as it were.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much.
Real hard work begins.
So yeah, that's kind of a summary of who I am and what I do as a historian.
Very nice.
Yeah, I mean, if some of you, if you've been reading the blog from the beginning rather than the podcast itself, Gordon actually had a couple of guest posts there with us, and because, like, well, like he said, he'd been in Winchester a long time, and we both, Alex and I, studied in Winchester as well. So obviously, we're very well acquainted with Gordon. So you know, he's really been a very important member of the community there, and it's interesting because I think Gordon was actually the first person I met at uni, and it's really cool that you know he's gone on and doing all of these other things now, which I still don't fully comprehend half of them, to be honest. But that's because you know you deal with some very specific things, and I actually wanted to ask if you could you know, for the people listening at home, break down a bit more the type of sources that you've been working with, because I think, at least for me, those were exactly the type of sources that steered me away from that field of research. I used to find things, you know, legal documents and bonds and things like that really dry, really, really dry. So I just never sparked an interest in it. So can you tell us why should anyone care about these documents, why you care about these documents, and, you know, a bit more about what type of information they hold?
Yeah, certainly. I suppose broadly the types of documents to look at are the documents produced by the English royal administration in the later Middle Ages. I've particularly looked at the records of the King's Bench. Now, effectively, these are criminal records.
Mm-hmm.
And criminal records can tell you lots of different things. One, they can tell you what sort of crimes people are committing, but they can tell you a lot more as well, because they have information in them such as who this person is, what the surname is. After 1413 in England, when you have the Statute of Additions, you know their occupation or their social status, you know where they're from. So you can know if they're committing crimes in a particular place with family members, potentially with people that live nearby them. So I think the kind of key thing is a lot of this material seems quite dry, but once you get into it and understand the processes behind it, you can start seeing some quite interesting things. The other advantage of this type of material is, and this is quite heretical to some people, you can actually start counting things. Now, you can't count the number of crimes that happened. No way, that's not what they show. But what they do show is enforcement, how laws were being enforced,
yes.
Which gives you an insight into what's actually happening at a local level. Another set of documents within that that I've got quite interested in at the moment is records in the King's Bench. And what they are is letters, there's maybe four or five a year from the King to Chief mm-hmm. Justice of the King's Bench, really stopping the proceedings against someone. Now, those proceedings can be restarted if the King wants. But the interesting thing is, a lot of these people are quite low status. So there's a question about, okay, why is the King or why is the Crown getting involved in these things? So what I would say is these very, very small kind of dry documents are a way into thinking about bigger issues, about how both politics operated in terms of high politics, but also mm-hmm. how kind of society operated at a much, much more local level. So if used with care and attention, they can give you a good insight into the kind of full spectrum of late medieval life and the experiences of life.
Mm. Makes sense. Have you come across any interesting answers to that question of why the King is getting involved and stopping proceedings in any of these cases?
There's one particularly interesting case I came across, which is relating to someone who was an associate of the Earl of Oxford in 1487. And clearly, when you actually start looking at the document itself, the King at the time, Henry VII, signs it at Kenilworth just about a week or so before the Battle of Stoke. The crime itself is something from about 10 years earlier, and it's this individual has been accused of effectively beating someone up and robbing them. Now, we don't know if this is a malicious case or not, but the key thing is this person being with the Earl of Oxford, effectively Henry VII's right-hand man, has allowed him to get away with it. That's probably the most interesting of all the cases of that type of record that I've came across over the past 7 or 8 years.
Okay, yeah.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, I guess we don't really think that these type of documents are going to give you such an insight into sort of more ordinary side of life, but it's good that they are there. And I know that this is a field that doesn't only just put off people like me, but I know it's a bit of a neglected part of history. So hence one of the reasons why we have Gordon here to promote it for you guys, because there is a lot of work to do there, in not just in the National Archives, but a lot of local archives as well, I suspect. I don't know what your experience of that has been, Gordon, in terms of accessibility with sources and things like that. Have you noticed any of these documents being a bit more off the beaten path, or are they easily available?
They are easily available. I've probably run into the trap of thinking everything's at the National Archives and everything's held by the Crown. I have done some trips to local archives. In some ways, the National Archives is much easier in terms of their ordering system.
Yeah.
You can order a couple of days in advance. Go there and you show up, your documents are there. Local archives all have their own peculiarities to them. But many of them have lots of interesting things, and in many ways they're probably underused. Now, I think the reason for that is that local archives, a lot of them have maybe two or three small things that are of interest to you. But if it's a 5-hour round trip just to see those things, do you have time? Do you have the money to do that? When you're a PhD student, you've got the time, but you don't potentially have the money. Afterwards, you might have the money, but you don't potentially have the time. So I think that's one of the issues why people don't use the local records as much as they probably should, myself included.
No, I mean, that's a very fair observation, and something that, you know, I've been dwelling on about a lot lately, because, I mean, every other county and many cities have these records available, but we just sort of take them for granted or just simply neglect them. And, you know, there is a lot of work to be done there. But on that front, and now that we've spoken a bit more about the records that you work with, can you tell us a bit more about your research specifically, why you chose that subject and what you're doing at the moment? Because I believe what you are researching now is a bit different than your thesis and the background, isn't it? So can you tell us a bit more about what's album number two, essentially?
Album number two, there's a few options. I got quite interested in during my thesis was continental comparisons with what's happening in England. In many ways, the laws in England are about who can wear a lord's livery, who can be retained by a lord or a townsman or a cleric or a member of the gentry. Those laws are not exclusively English laws. The reason we think of them as mainly English laws is, one, England's got the best records for enforcement, and two, these laws have been central to how historians of England have seen the later Middle Ages, this kind of great rivalry between crown and nobility. And other countries have different grand narratives, as it were. So I'm looking at those kind of comparisons at the moment, particularly with the kind of Scottish examples, because the Scottish examples go on for longer than the English examples do, but we don't have the actual enforcement, we don't have that side of the coin. So there's different deductions that need to be made, and there's different things we need to go into for that. So I've started looking at them in a bit more detail. Now, whether there's enough for a full second album, as it were, or just a few singles or articles, as we'll find out soon enough, hopefully.
And with relation to that, you say that you don't see the enforcement in there. I think that's quite peculiar, considering that it's strange, because you said these records go on for longer, but then you don't see the enforcement. Is there any reason for that? Have you come across this on your research, or you can tell us about that?
I think possibly the reason might be Cromwell, but this is me thinking laterally. For Scotland, we've got very good Parliament records. So we know the laws that were passed, but we don't have an equivalent to the King's Bench records. So we don't have an equivalent really to the judicial records until a little bit later on. So for instance, one of the things I looked at in my initial research was, if you look at the Parliament rules in England during Richard II's reign and Henry IV's reign, which is the 1390s, early 1400s, We see lots of complaints saying these laws aren't being enforced. And you actually go to the records of the King's Bench and you see, well, they're not being enforced. There's no cases, which was some incredibly frustrating trips to the National Archives and a few existential crises. But for Scotland, we just don't have the equivalent of that from the King's Bench. So it's always been an issue that it's always been a topic that's not really been looked at. But I mean, one of the interesting things I've found looking at the actual text of these statutes a bit more is when you get to 1555, I think it is in Scotland, there's an act that effectively says the making of bonds and effectively these private arrangements that are common across the continent, I think are against the kind of, I think the exact phrase is against the authority of princes or something to that effect. Interestingly, historians tend to go on about Henry VII, Henry VIII in England being very anti-noble, anti these private arrangements, but there is no statements anywhere near as strong by any Tudor king on this. So I'm trying to kind of unpack why that might be the case at the moment, along with various other things.
I'm fascinated by this. It's such a foreign concept to me. It's interesting that you say, you know, this hasn't really been looked into very much at all, because one of the things I was going to ask you is, in comparison, and obviously you have the perspective then, in comparison, how much of this research obviously has more prominence in England than in Scotland? Do you think the research amount that's going into these type of records and history overall is the same, or is the Scottish side of things a bit more neglected overall?
I think the Scottish side of things are a bit more neglected. I think there's two basic reasons for that. One, fewer people work in Scotland than work in England. And second, there's more sources for people to look at, which... And sometimes reading the historiography of late medieval Scotland, there's a great myth that's coming into being that, you know, Scottish historiography is underdeveloped. It's really not, and it never has been. Mm-hmm. It's just a few people doing things. So it means that articles need to spend longer probably establishing basic facts about sources. Whereas maybe because more things are published on late medieval England, it's easier to say, well, this source is known to be okay, cite two articles, then go on. Whereas for Scottish historiography, maybe there's about three paragraphs of this is why this source is okay to use, as it were. So those kind of things maybe, I wouldn't say slow down the developments, but I think it just means different issues come to the fore. Also, there's the big question about the kind of these grand narratives, as it were. And English historiography is very much Magna Carta, Wars of the Roses, Glorious Revolution, the sort of kind of Whig idea of history. Or at least that's how it used to be. I mean, I don't think anyone actually thinks in those terms anymore, but it has those ideas of set, probably one or two. Actually, you're right, Ali, there are.
Never say never, just in case.
I was talking with real historians, though, on that, but yes, I do take your point. Whereas I think Scottish historiography has not got that same dichotomy between crown noble relations. It's there, but it's not as prominent. Other issues have been more prominent. So, for instance, the Wars of Independence, the late 14th century, have been more prominent. Now, historians have looked at the crown noble relations, particularly over the past 20, 30 years, but it's not been looked at for as long or in as great a depth as it has been in England, where most major aristocratic families have had at least one study on them, because it was, I think for decades, it was an easy topic for a PhD. Oh, these errors haven't been done, let's do them.
Do you think these narratives, especially when you compare the differing Scottish and English ones, do you think they have a basis in reality for this period?
Some of it does. I mean, I think there's always the temptation to say these grand historical narratives have no real basis in reality. It's just how much of a basis in reality is the question. I mean, I think the other big thing is, you know, royal government in England was a much bigger deal than it was in Scotland, but royal government in England was a much bigger deal than it was anywhere, even probably even in France. I mean, French kings call themselves the most Christian kings, but, you know, the English kings are the ones that probably have a greater sense of what's going on in their kingdoms.
Yeah, I was going to ask, obviously, you said that during your investigations, you also looked at comparisons between, you know, what the situation was with this in England and its continental parallels. What, apart from France, I suspect, were there other areas that you looked into, and did you find some really remarkable differences?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing, I mean, it was one of these kind of traditional things you do when you're doing your PhD, where you go to a big research library where all of the different historiography of different countries is kind of, okay, here's where the kind of French stuff is, here's the German stuff, here's the Spanish stuff. And it literally was just, you know, going through indexes and seeing what was said in the secondary literature. So there's probably lots of things that I've missed. Interesting thing was that there's no obvious equivalent laws in France at a national level, but there seems to be a couple of at a local level. One in Rouen in 1424, which is just after a few years after Henry V conquers northern France. So that's an interesting one. The other really interesting one is the Valois Dukes in Burgundy. Now, at this point, the Duchy of Burgundy is almost a semi-independent state. And actually, when historians talk about Burgundy, they're not just talking about the area in France, they're talking about most of what we would normally see as Belgium and Holland and Luxembourg. But there's a few laws there that almost mimic the English legislation identically. So, I mean, that's interesting that these ideas are getting copied across the continent, but there doesn't seem to be any of great coordination. There's no one saying, oh, look, you know, what's that country doing? I also found a very interesting law in Norway right at the start of the 14th century, so before anything that I could see anywhere else. And again, this is coming from secondary literature, so it might be inaccurate, but it does seem there's a law there, I think it's 1314, 1315, where there's attempts by the king to limit the number of sworn housecarls that particular nobles could have, you know, decades before it's found in the kind of bigger, you know, the kind of bigger states of Europe, as it were. Because when we see these things in a European context, it tends to be England and France then assume that's happening everywhere, whereas this kind of centre-periphery thing that some historians have spoke about in the past, where you've got your big states and they're the ones we look at, and you miss out the kind of small satellite states around. So it's one of these kind of interesting quirks that seems to complicate everything. How it complicates it, I'm not quite sure, but I know it's significant in some way.
No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, what really intrigues me about this, and the reason why I was asking about, you know, how it compared, is because, you know, I like thinking about things holistically. And I was wondering if there were specific, I don't know, trigger issues, either politically or socially, either in the British Isles or in Europe, that may have brought this sort of, well, what I thought could potentially be a homogeneous set of laws and rules and whatnot, but obviously that's not necessarily the case. So you think there is any reason for that, or any particular topics that really push this forward in the case of Britain?
I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, the easy answer a lot of historians say is it must be the Black Death. Anything right. in the 14th or 15th century, any change must be attributed to the Black Death. I don't think for this topic the Black Death seems to be that important.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. It just seems that historians maybe say, okay, late medieval, well, let's see if the Black Death's got anything to do with it, but it doesn't seem to.
So do you think maybe there is something more rooted with just the general statesmanship or statecraft, I guess? Or
I think that's got something to do with it. I think that there is something there about the rise of the state or the rise of the late medieval state, development of government, etc. What precisely it is, I'm not quite sure, but there's definitely something in that, as it were.
So it's not usually something where the king or the crown is being kind of directly threatened by someone else being a bit too powerful necessarily, is it? Or just kind of trying to preempt that?
Possibly in some cases. I mean, the interesting thing is when we go to the English legislation, particularly of kind of 1390s, early 15th century, it's the Commons, it's the kind of MPs in the House of Commons that are the ones pushing for this legislation and constantly telling the king, we need to do something about this. Now, interestingly, the Commons are the same people who are from the same class of people who are not enforcing the law, and also the same class of people who are probably retaining too many people illegally. It's all the gentry. But interestingly, it's very much a commons-driven thing in England until really Edward IV and Henry VII, until the Wars of the Roses, where the Crown takes a much, much firmer stance on this. But even then, towns are still passing their own bylaws about this legislation as well. So it's one of these things, it's one of these kind of great tricks about generalisations, about is it always a case that the Crown is scared about the power of the nobility? Probably not, and I suspect that's the case in most pre-modern societies. It's just, where do you draw the lines? The interesting point, I would always think or argue.
Yeah, it is always something I think about where, you know, I'm more familiar with earlier periods, and I always think these kings always seem like they're in such a precarious position sometimes, but I guess later on they probably don't have to be as worried.
In some ways, yes, but, you know, there's no police forces until the 19th century.
Yeah.
You know, the Crown is always, you know, feeding the goodwill of its kind of richest, you know, the great and the good, as it were, in order to kind of govern. It's just, and this is probably true in the early modern period as well, it's just when you get to the early modern period, historians are very interested in this idea about the rise of the state, the rise of the rise of the bureaucrat, as it were. And that's no doubt happening, but they're still in the 16th and 17th century, you know, important noble families. They still need towns to kind of help run things and collect taxes. So it's never absolute, as it were.
From what you're saying, it all seems to point into that general direction, at least from the way I'm seeing it. In any case, no, it was just interesting because I thought maybe war or some form of social issues, riots or things like that, maybe pushing some of these things forward. But it's interesting how that goes. But yeah, the other thing I was wondering is, like, when you are actually looking at the records, are there any specific things, whether it's on the crime side of things or anything around it, that seems to crop up more, and in either the English or the Scottish records that you've been looking at? Like, is there some form of repetitive issue that keeps on being pulled up by these records or the King's Benches, and that sort of create this narrative and perhaps the need for these rules and these laws and these documents to exist?
I mean, one of the interesting things about looking at the King's Bench in particular is, well, the King's Bench, I mean, I've said the King's Bench records, but there's about four different classes of King's Bench records, actually five different classes that I looked at. Once you get to the kind of plea side, which is the kind of final, this is it, almost no one shows up in court. The number of cases that gets a resolution is between about 20 and 25%. And I think the reason for that is that, in part, it's easy to get a pardon. Pardons are part of the process. And things tend to get sorted out at a local level. Kind of recourse to the state, in some ways, is kind of a last option for many. So I would say that's probably one of the sort of key things that I would say comes from the records. The Crown itself is interested in keeping law and order, but it knows it can't completely eradicate lawlessness, as it were. It tries its best, but there's kind of only limits in what it can do. So I think what the records show of late medieval royal government is ultimately what the Crown wants to be able to do, but also the limits of what it can do.
And would you say those limitations are not so strict as Alex was sort of stipulating with nobles and gentry and that sort of stuff? There is not a lot of meddling then, so then they can pretty much do as they please, I guess.
It depends on, I mean, king by king, it depends. So for instance, for England in the 15th century, with Henry VI, you can get away with a lot under Henry VI.
Really?
It gets to Henry VII, who is constantly trying to bleed money from everyone. It is very difficult to get anything past Henry VII. So it's a case-by-case basis in many ways. There's a lot of things that people can avoid in the late Middle Ages, paying tax, for instance, tax returns are always a key area of discussion. Actually being convicted, particularly if you're a noble for a crime, is very uncertain, unless, of course, you're a noble and you commit treason, at which point you do get convicted and you tend to get your head cut off.
Nice.
It's effective, I guess. Problem removed by the root. No, it is... It's as you were saying, these things like tax evasion and things like that, and obviously treason, it just got me thinking, what's the most outrageous thing you found in these records that crop up? Whether it's just the one particular case or something that you'd think, because I guess, tax evasion and not paying your taxes is not an isolated item of the Middle Ages, right? It's 21st century and we still have the same issue, and no one wants to be paying their money, it seems. But I just wonder if there is something really strange that seems to have been really aggravating, or something that maybe was actually quite common but that you didn't expect to find, and that it's perhaps a bit weird from our modern point of view.
I'm not sure how common it is, and can't think of any examples that I found off the top of my head, but I know a couple of colleagues have found some. I remember coming across them at some point. But indictments in which effectively the jury share a surname with the person indicted.
Okay.
And in a small village, they're almost certainly related. so that's one thing. That is probably, to modernise, looks incredibly corrupt.
Yeah, no, it seems, I guess, but you don't think it's very common at all. So it's just probably just one of those one-off things.
I mean, it's difficult to say just because, obviously, with jury names, if you've got the same surname, then you know about the father's side. But obviously, you know, you don't have the same surname as all of your relatives on your mother's side.
Yeah, of course.
That normally is that way. So there's probably a lot more family connections going on in these things than the records would indicate. I think, you know, the importance of, you know, familial relations for understanding how things worked at a very local level, I think it's important, probably under-recognised. Not that historians haven't recognised that, maybe sometimes it's not been emphasised as much as it should have been.
No, that's fair enough. I mean, yeah, that happens, doesn't it? We tend to not necessarily forget, but sort of overlook certain things, and it doesn't necessarily transpire the way we want to in that sense. Just thinking of the time, because we are starting to get sort of to the last 15 minutes or so. Is there any specific area of the research that you've been doing that has really sort of tickled your fancy? Like, what's the most exciting thing that you've been researching recently to do with this and that you think would be quite cool to share with people out there? As much as you can share, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, recently, one of the kind of benefits over the past couple of years in my current post is having past 5 or 6 years, having to teach almost everything under the sun, which has meant reading quite widely on a lot of areas. So when I come back to looking at these topics I looked at as a research student, when you're really just focused on one area, quite interesting. One thing that I do have coming out hopefully the next year or so is an article looking at the role of emotions in the Wars of the Roses, particularly things such as hate and fear, and actually thinking they are much stronger drivers to the Wars of the Roses than I think people previously accepted.
Yeah, I can see why. Like, it's silly, isn't it? You would think, yeah, they would totally hate their guts, but I can see where you're coming from, because you didn't necessarily think that would have been such an important aspect of these type of conflicts. But no, I'm really intrigued by this. Please carry on.
I think one of the things that I think it's been, when discussing things like emotions, it has become very easy for historians to see them as just performative, to see the sources as just, you know, narrative texts. You know, the idea you can read a historical source just like you can read fiction has maybe tended to get historians thinking, well, what's the performative aspect of why this person is angry, rather than the fact this person is genuinely pissed off. I think that's something that probably has been underplayed. Again, it's not one of these things people haven't recognised, and I'm not saying it's the main driver of the wars, but it's very much there. And I think the interesting thing when we get to the Wars of the Roses is we're not just looking at individuals, we're looking at collective emotions or collective fears. There's a couple of good examples of this. Early 1461, which is after the Battle of Wakefield, and a Lancastrian force, it's October, it's before the Battle of Wakefield, Lancastrian forces under Margaret of Anjou are having to write to the City of London, basically to try to allay fears that they're going to sack the city. And it seems genuine that in London there's a genuine concern that this force is going to sack the city, which helps make sense of why they ultimately supported the Yorkists and Edward IV wins the first phase of the Wars of the Roses. And even interestingly, you get to Richard III in 1483, his usurpation. The accounts of some of the people in London, there's a tangible fear about a civil war re-erupting. Now, it doesn't in 1483, but those fears are very much alive. And I think sometimes the tendency to downplay the scale of the violence in the Wars of the Roses, which a necessary corrective to previous historiography, has probably neglected the role of emotions. You know, it's not just, people don't just act through issues to do with money. It's not a spreadsheet, as it were.
They're not going to be perfectly rational and all the decisions perfectly political. It's going to be based on your emotion at some extent, at least. Is there, from these like original sources though, how easy is it to actually glean the idea of how much emotion is driving people? Is it described much?
Described tangentially in the chronicles, and I think that gets back to how much can we believe the chronicles. And again, I think there's a danger sometimes thinking that the chronicles are all lying, it's all fiction, it's all a nice story. Now, plenty of chroniclers do lie through their teeth, do make things up. There is a lot of fiction, but when you get to the level of specific incidents, why are they making up this specific incident, or why are they attributing that emotion? I think the thing I want to get across is that, you know, the chronicle accounts aren't just made up of a vacuum. You know, there are parts of it that are believable. So I think there's that. And then I think there's other accounts like letters. And, you know, why are you writing a letter to someone? Oh, you're trying to lay the fears. Well, you're genuinely concerned about their fears. So I think sometimes the tendency to maybe over-theorise about the sources and dress everything up in languages about everything being performative, and sometimes hinders as much as it illuminates, as it were.
Yeah, it makes sense. If you assume everything is a lie, it can be just as misleading as assuming everything's true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and you know, I think that's a really good point, Gordon, because it just, I just can so easily see my students in class doing exactly that same exercise, just picking a piece of whatever. And because it's been ingrained almost from day one, when you're a historian, you know, question everything, don't trust anything.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, in certain periods, like, well, I mean, obviously in the late medieval period as well, but coming from an early medieval, you know, setting where things are perhaps a bit less uncertain, or maybe a bit more embellished, let's say, it kind of makes you think, oh, then, you know, out of this huge piece of information that I have here, which is this chronicle that essentially, like, I'm thinking particularly the Anglo-Saxon chronicle, right? Half of this is rubbish. But like you said, even in the rubbish, there is a value, because there is not just a random reason why the chronicler wrote that. There is still a message coded there, or something that they want to convey for people. And more importantly, you know, we should be thinking, well, there was plenty of stuff happening, surely, if they went through all that effort to just make some stuff up rather than just stick to the truth. There must be a reason for it. And, you know, that whole idea of collective emotions is something that I'm, you know, it's now taking me back to my research and how we feel as a society, particularly back then, was so powerful. And it still is so powerful. And it really brings people together and pushes people, I would say, more than certain political agendas. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're human, we're emotional beings. And truly, the whole emotional side of things, I think, sometimes it's a bit too far removed from history. Sometimes we try to be a bit too clinical as historians. And I mean, you know, we are not scientists. We wear no lab coat and have to have, you know, zero biohazard around our research. So I think it's really cool that you are actually taking a stab at this and putting it a bit more on the forefront. Not that it's been ignored, but actually giving it a bit more of the credit that it's due. Because, I mean, yeah. If you're going to war with someone, or if you have a political rivalry or anything like that. You know, that's not just going to be based on the fact that so-so managed to achieve a better position than you or whatever. It's clearly going to make you mad at that person or jealous or whatever. And that is, it's a story worth telling because it gives us an insight into people, and it comes down to that sort of, not necessarily the biographical pieces that go about knowing every single little detail about this person or that person, but actually sort of appreciating how humanity, our humanity as a characteristic, is what actually drives history together rather than just these big events or whatever you want to call them. So I think is really fascinating. But on that front, and as Alex, you know, mentions specific things, is there any particular phrases or language or terms that you've noticed that are sort of formulaically or not even formulaically, that just appear to convey certain emotions, or that you read them and you get this specific sense of fear or hatred or whatever it is? Or is it more like the document holistically just presents some form of, I guess, aura, we could call it? I don't know.
I think there's a lot of kind of interesting things there. I think the first thing is this idea that just because you can't believe everything doesn't mean you should not believe anything. And I think that's an issue that gets sidelined a little bit. In terms of what you were saying about emotions and particular phrases, I don't trust my knowledge of Latin well enough to kind of talk about the Latin sources. But the Middle English sources, the word dread comes up quite a lot. And
dread.
Loved him not. They seem to be the kind of main phrases that come up. Now, there's people that are much, much better linguists and can explain this these elements much better than me, but they seem to be the phrases that seem to indicate some sort of fear and some sort of dread that people are trying to alleviate. And I think what you say about the importance of emotions and driving things is quite interesting. I mean, one of the kind of big distinctions within history, although it never gets explained, is those that are very source orientated, and I would probably draw myself in that very much look at sources, and those that are very theory orientated.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm definitely not in that camp by a mile. I've been able to get through most of an academic career without having to read Foucault. I don't think I'll get through my entire career without reading them, but I've had a good stab at it so far. But I think a lot of the discussion around emotions tends to come from those that are based on the more theoretical social science-esque approach to history, or the more issues around postmodernism, the more probably less traditional, more interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I'm very much on that very traditional camp. There's no point in lying about that. But I think that very traditional camp sometimes gets worried about maybe engaging too much with this big literature on things like emotions, etc. And it might also come down to the sorts of questions people ask of the sources, because ultimately that's what historians are, the people who ask questions of particular sets of sources.
It's factually true. It all depends what side of the fence, I guess, you are on. And I mean, I don't think it's bad or good of either side to take it more one end or the other. I see advantages to both approaches, of course. But it is. I can't believe you've not read Foucault. Sorry, that just stuck with me. I guess it makes sense. But okay, maybe I'm not as surprised as I think I am. It just sort of took me by surprise more than now, thinking about it with the knowledge I have of you. as a person, as a historian, perhaps it's not so surprising. Yeah, okay, fine. Putting it in the right frame, this is fair. But yeah, no,
For context, one book that I think that might sound incredibly dull and boring is actually well written is T.F. Tout, Chapters on Administrative History of England from, I think, the 1920s and 30s. Now, I'm not saying I've read all of it, but the bits I have read are actually quite interesting.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I was going to say, I wouldn't say it's the most exciting read of all times, and I certainly haven't got through all of it back to back myself, because, I mean, for that you need a lot of courage, in my opinion. but it promotes certain ideas that are not perhaps let's say encouraged from a more traditional historical and historiographical point of view, which are good in giving you an edge as to how you ask some of those questions. And I think that's what I like about postmodernism in some ways, and I never thought I would say that myself, because I remember very clearly being a first year university student thinking, ugh, this module I have to do about historiography and postmodernism, I hate it, and look at me now reading Foucault. But I mean, I guess these things happen. But it's, you know, it's that the questions that we ask about sources and how we ask them and why we ask them, I guess a lot of the time is the issue. Because like you were saying, for example, when you're doing a PhD investigation, you are so focused in this one specific thing. And you know, you always keep on remembering what are your research questions, what are your, you know, your topics, whatever. But I think sometimes what a lot of people struggle with is not the what or the where or the when or the how, but the why. And not just why, but why do you care and why should others care? Not just why this, if that makes sense.
I mean, I think one of the kind of key things that helps explain what you just said there is this idea of academic genealogies, of who taught you and who taught them, as it were. Now, in terms of postmodernism, I do remember being younger, and this was when I was an undergrad, graduate in Glasgow. One of the lecturers up there described postmodernism, quote, as a disease in history that thankfully historians have stopped flirting with. Which, you know, it's just one of these interesting things that, you know, 15, 16 years later, I can still remember it. Less flippantly, I suppose I was in a beneficial position of having two supervisors, one who was very much an expert on the area, and the other who was a specialist in French history, and therefore his big thing was always, well, what's the bigger point? And I always think that in some ways, it's not just it's not purely that who your supervisor is tells you what to study. I don't think that probably does happen somewhere, but I don't think it happens just as much as maybe myths come out. I think what happens is, the people you're speaking to about your research are the ones that say to you, oh, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? And I think that's where these kind of questions come in, because, you know, ultimately a lot of research questions in history, and I'm pretty sure others have said this to you as well, come over cups of coffee, lunch meetings, and a drink after a seminar, because that's when you start talking about particular issues, particular topics. And that's kind of where we could ask that question of that particular source starts coming in. So I think a lot of ways how historians kind of end up coming to these questions comes from who taught you, what sort of things did they say, well, this is a good thing to read, or, you know, who your friends are who said, have you thought about this? And I think those kind of more human factors are probably just as important to actually driving the historical agenda. And I assume probably this is the same in every other academic discipline as well, that these things probably drive the agenda much more than I think is apparent when you read a book or an article.
Yeah.
I always think one of the most interesting things about a book or an article is, you know, the acknowledgements, because then that kind of might get you into, okay, so where's their thinking coming from? And everyone does it as well. Any professional historian who says they don't, I don't believe them.
No, I agree. That just made me think of the acknowledgements on my thesis just now. They're probably a bit strange, and that explains probably a lot of where my strange ideas come from. Oh. But I think it's really, you know, you've essentially hit it in the nail there for me. And it's funny because in a way that takes us back to the whole point of emotions and your research, that, you know, we tend to disassociate the human aspect and the human element in all of these things, whether it's a legal document or where your research is coming from. You know, as much as we try to not be biased, yeah, there is a bias. There is always going to be a bias, because at the end of the day, like, you know, like we've been saying, you're a human being. You have thoughts, feelings, questions, and you search for answers. And, you know, whether it's through legal records or chronicles or just by reading Foucault on an afternoon or two, or probably more than two, and a lot of coffee, you know, that's what matters. But as we are approaching the end, and we're sort of thinking about these questions more than answers, I have one final question for you, Gordon, and it's sort of thinking about where your career is at the moment and your research and, you know, the path that you've followed, because particularly, like you said, now that you've become a lot more open and exposed to all of these other fields, simply because, you know, at uni you just have to teach all these things. What do you think would be or are interesting things, not necessarily just in your field, but sort of in late medieval English or even late medieval Scottish thing, that you wish that young historians or new historians that are coming out would really sort of dig into a bit more, sort of dropping your 2p on the subject to maybe inspire a young academic to pursue their own cups of coffee with a bunch of other historians somewhere else? What do you think would be cool or exciting?
I would say two things. I would say, first of all, more comparative history.
Yeah.
But comparative history that is not focused on the secondary literature, that's focused on the primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
The big issue with that is languages. And it does mean taking time to get your head around some languages that might not be familiar. But I would say very much more comparative sources, look at things in a more comparative aspect. I think the second one is, don't be shut down or restricted by the chronologies that you get at undergraduate level.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the big things that historians have been noting for, I mean, at least 30 years now, there's been articles coming out on this, the continuities between the later Middle Ages and the early modern period. However, most university courses, when they're getting put together, stop around about 1500 and start around about 1500. When universities are appointing staff, they appoint a late medievalist or an early modernist.
Mm-hmm.
So those people then end up teaching quite a lot in that area. So how students are, how students come to the topic means that, you know, so-and-so teaches me this topic and no one teaches this topic. These are different topics, whereas maybe just an appreciation of that, maybe a bit more. I mean, obviously, when, you know, we put modules together, you know, there has to be a start point and an end point.
Yeah,
and it has to reflect the kind of thinking and scholarship on it. But once you get past that, I would say think about changing chronological boundaries as much as thinking more comparatively. They seem to kind of two best ways forward.
Yeah, I think these are very, very good pieces of advice. And I mean, I don't want to be pedantic about this. I know I always say this, but you know, you have now hear us. We're on episode what, Alex? I can't even remember.
Nine.
Episode 9. And I think every single episode, someone has from different specialties told you all, guys, the importance of knowing more languages. You know, whatever it is, you just have to these days, because otherwise you're so restricted by the materials that you can study, and not just study, but build upon and do comparative work, like Gordon is saying, that is actually very important these days to show the dynamics in different societies, not just isolated, but, you know, in comparison with the whole world, I mean, it's an age of globalism, but, you know, how people have interacted in the past has been a lot more global than we actually give it credit for. And I guess that's another area there in terms of, you know, moving the boundaries of the chronologies and the comparisons. You know, it's very good doing local things and all of that. It's awesome, and we do need more local histories because sometimes we tend to neglect them a lot. But think about what's out there and how it all merges together, because they are not isolated incidents a lot of the time. So yeah, yep. 9 times now. So you can't really
like
say
I'm being personally addressed here.
Yeah, you can't really say, oh, I went into doing historical research of the Middle Ages and or other things, and I didn't know any languages, and no one told me about it. So yeah, no, that's and yeah, comparative studies are definitely something that we need more of. Not just interdisciplinary studies. Because, you know, you can bring disciplines together from all types of perspectives, but comparative of societies, of time periods, of anything. Yeah. Because that's really how we learn how those chronologies are actually not so maybe set in stone, and these concepts are a bit more fluid than what we anticipated.
Yeah, nothing really means much kind of in a vacuum, does it? So.
No, indeed. Well, I think that's actually on the clock. So that's all we're going to have time for today. Thank you, Gordon, very much for coming on board today and for talking to us about all of the things that you've been doing and about Album 2. And I really hope that Album 2 actually becomes an album, not just, you know, a couple of collections of greatest hits sort of thing.
Well, that's fine,
but,
too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it would be a lot more wholesome if you have the final product there. So, yeah, thank you so much for that.
Krom, thank you very much for having me.
No, anytime. Brilliant. And, yeah, thank you everyone for listening. Yeah. No, that was sync. That was the first time we've synced. We're getting good at this.
Yeah.
Right, nice and one. That's it. Night.
All right. Goodbye, everyone.